In this episode, Mark sits down with legendary drummer Wes Starr to talk about his career that started in Rome, Georgia, and has taken him all over the world. Wes's resume includes playing with Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jimmy Page, Jimmy Buffett, Delbert McClinton, Hal Ketchum, Blaze Foley, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, Bob Dylan, Kim Wilson, Joe Ely, Omar and the Howlers, Asleep at the Wheel, Anson Funderburk, Jimmy Vaughan, and our own Mark Hummel, and believe it or not, Tiny Tim. We hope you enjoy this episode, and please subscribe to this podcast and to our YouTube channel, where you can watch the video versions of all our episodes.
So welcome, everyone. My name is Mark Hummel. This is Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party, and we are brought to you by our sponsors, Electrify Records, Seidel Harmonicas, and Mountaintop Records. And the cut you just heard was off an album called The Hustle Is Really On that I did for Electrify Records, and it features a number of great local musicians like Kid Anderson and June Corr and Sid Morris, but it also features the Golden State Lone Star Review, which Wes Starr and I were both a part of, along with Anson Funderburg and Little Charlie Beatty and R.W. Grigsby. And so we're going to be talking to Wes, who has moved from Texas to California. And so we're going to just be talking about Wes's history, because he's really one of the premier drummers out of Texas who has played with just everybody on the scene. He originally is from Rome, Georgia, as R.W. Grigsby, our bass player, is from, and they grew up playing together as teenagers in high school, correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit about your history growing up in Rome, Georgia, because your dad was a radio engineer?
Dad was a radio engineer at one of the most powerful radio stations in the Southeast. They were a 50,000-watt station, a WRGA from Rome, Georgia. And that was real. I had a great childhood, and my dad was a really well-respected man. And I had three brothers, and they all became engineers. And I was kind of the black sheep. My dad had started
as all rock and rollers.
That's right. You know, I did. My father didn't. By the time I came along, he didn't insist that I go into that. But I did go to vocational school and junior college and got a little two-year certificate, so I had some knowledge, just about enough to get me in trouble. And you know, I acted like I knew stuff, but sometimes I didn't. As a kid, and then early in my like 12, 13, 14, I would go to the radio station and out to the transmitter. But at the station, they had a lot of music because we were on the train line between Chattanooga and Atlanta. So for big bands and the Chitlin' Circuit bands, a lot of them, if they had a layover, a day off, they would stay at the hotel across from the station, the Forest Hotel, and which had conveniently had a billiard hall in the basement. And a couple of my memories were I had to go down to see the Sammy Kaye Orchestra do a broadcast.
Wow.
And when I was a kid. And the only thing I really didn't like going down the broadcast, which as I got a little older, I wouldn't go anymore, which is kind of ignorant on my part, so, is my dad always made me wear a suit.
Ah.
But the cool thing with Sammy Kaye's band, it was about half Afro-American and half white guys and from the Northeast. And after they did their set, they all went back to the hotel, and my dad was kind of a world-class snooker player. Huh. So I got to hang out with these guys, and they were smoking cigars and talking the lingo, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. So
right.
That kind of planted a seed.
Yeah.
And then having a brother 5 years older than me, and we had a big basement in our house, so that's where the bands practiced. My brother was an up-and-coming guitar player, and the bands that he were in when I was a kid up till like 14, 15, they were pretty popular bands, and they always rehearsed in our house. And I would sit up on the steps leading from the main floor of the house down to the basement and listen to them. And when they'd take a break to go to the store or go out back, smoke cigarettes, I'd go down and play on the drums. And that's kind of how it started for me.
It's just, you kind of had some training and in insight into
right
bands and musicians and all that.
Yeah. And then you know, that's how kind of how I met Richard and Ronnie Gray. We were the nucleus of the band we started, and Ronnie's brother played in my brother's band, so that's how it all connected. And then they needed a drummer, so Frank, Ronnie's brother, had told me about that his brother needed a drummer. So I didn't even have a drum set. So I borrowed drums from the school, marching drums, and put together a drum set, and borrowed some stuff from my brother's drummer in his band, Leslie. And I met him at the Rome Teen Center, and no practice or nothing, and we just played with Born to Be Wild and whatever was popular at the time. And you know, people ask me about why do you play the way I play, because I play a right-handed set left-handed, because literally the way that happened was when I set up the drums, I didn't know what I was doing, and I put the big cymbal, the ride cymbal, on my left. So about 6 months down the road, my brother's drummer, Leslie, saw me play. Said, "Hey, you're doing it all wrong. You got the cymbal on the wrong side." And by then, I'd already started.
You already were
developing.
You were already there.
So,
yeah, right.
So that's the reason I play like that, because there's not many people, as you know, that play right-handed set left-handed. So it's unique.
Now, the other thing that everyone always comments on is the way you hold your stick.
Right.
Because of your accident.
Right. There's, you know, there's a traditional where you hold in your left hand a stick across this way, and like this, and then there's match grip where you hold them both like that, and then you have the claw grip where I hold mine like this, and people every show will ask me about it, and if I don't want to tell them the story, I'll just go table saw because I cut my thumb off. So that's how that came about. So I had to adapt.
Yeah.
Because it's still, you know, when I hit it, it just goes zing, zing. So,
and
it changed my style, I think, in a lot of ways. For the first few years, it was really hard. I had to kind of reinvent myself, in a lot of wood shedding just to go around the drums without my sticks flying everywhere, holding it like that, and doing rolls. And so I had to simplify things, but also it made me play things differently, and through time it's just kind of made, kind of, you know, I have my own sound.
Yeah, you definitely do.
It's
you
definitely do. A little different than a lot of guys.
Yeah. Now, I met you through my brother, because my brother worked with your wife at the time.
That's right.
In Austin. My brother was living in Pflugerville, and you'd moved, you started in Georgia, you and R.W. Richard Grigsby moved out to California, Santa Barbara, around the same time?
He came out a year after me. Me and Ronnie, our singer, moved out together.
All right.
And then Richard came out because he had a child. You know, his child
was born
when he was 15.
Right. His daughter.
He had responsibilities. He had to do some growing up. But they came out about a year later, and then I moved to Texas. And then it was a few years later before Richard came out there.
Right. So he followed you from Santa Barbara to Texas.
Yeah, from Georgia to California, California.
How much longer was it before he moved out?
I want to say it was about 4 or 5 years.
Okay. And now, did you guys work? Did you work in bands in Santa Barbara together?
Yes, we did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when he came out to, I mean, the interesting thing about all this is it's a very incestuous world of musicians.
Absolutely.
And that all these musicians that we're going to be talking about, so many of them knew each other or know each other. And so you have this constant kind of movement, people from bands to bands. And you've played with so many people in Texas.
Yeah.
Practically the gamut of every, you know, especially in country and blues, I would say.
You know, there were a couple guys in Austin, and we got drummers that we were kind of known as the roots drummers. That's the way we were looked at. So, of course, I went out there to play blues. And then when I started having kids and got off the road, then I got with all the songwriters. And there was just a couple of us that were kind of considered well, we could do that. You know, we were rootsy drummers.
Yeah. So you, George Raines.
Well, the blues drummers were, you know, like Mike Buck, George Raines.
Would Frosty be in there?
Frosty would be in there. And Frosty did a lot of the session stuff with the songwriters. George pretty much stayed to the rock and the blues stuff mainly.
Right.
And, you know,
and George played with Boz, too,
yeah,
right?
Yes, he
played
did.
With Boz Keg, yeah, in the original band, yeah, in California. So, okay, so let me try. I'm trying to get a handle on this because it really is everywhere in a sense of Austin and what happened there. The first guy you got with would be Omar, correct?
Right, and that was through Kim Wilson.
That was through Kim.
Kim.
So did you know Kim in Santa Barbara?
Kim had already moved up to Minneapolis and had just moved down to Austin, but he was coming back and forth to Santa Barbara because his folks were there.
Right.
And whenever he came back, he'd always play. So I actually had met him after he had moved, but I met him in Santa Barbara.
Right.
Him and Nick Conley. And, you know, he kept telling me, you need to come out to Austin. You need to come out to Austin.
Interesting. Yeah.
He told me that friend of his was going to be looking for a drummer, and that's what got me out there. So I flew out there and Kim.
So he hooked you up with Omar?
Yes, he.
Wow.
I flew out there and, you know, he picked me up at the airport. It was my birthday, and the first music I saw was we went to the Soap Creek Saloon, and there was a Triple Threat review of Stevie Vaughan, W.C. Clark, Lou Ann, and Chris on drums. And I sat in with them. That was my introduction to Austin.
Crazy.
And I liked it.
Yeah. So. I remember during those days, that must have been, would that be mid-70s?
That was 79.
79, yeah. Okay. Because I remember I had actually really considered moving to Austin around that time. Well, I even started selling Kim my record collection and regretted it.
Well, that was the time to be there.
Yeah, it really was.
It really was.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, when I did my audition with Omar and found a house. And so I had a month period to get my stuff together in California and then me and my first wife move out there.
Right.
So was on a major label or a label, really.
Yeah.
So we were kind of all in the same boat together. And the Cobras, Omar, Stevie, Christopher Cross, we all had the same agency, so we all did these 6-week tours together.
Interesting.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, the interesting thing about with this would be a good time for me to kind of interject Stevie Ray Vaughan is there was a real love and hate relationship with him with club owners and fans alike because club owners always wanted him to turn down.
Right. I'd always heard
and,
that.
And when we would be on tour in order for, if there were two or three bands, if it's like, say, Steven, just Omar, sometimes for us to get paid, we would have to go back on stage and finish Stevie's set for us to get paid.
Wow. Incredible. I remember, you know, I was talking to Junior Watson recently, and he told me that he had a cassette that Stevie had given him. Mm-hmm. To try to get him gigs in California. And I think he still had like the letter or something that that Stevie had given him. And he said Stevie didn't speak to him after that because he never got him any gigs.
Well, I understand that.
I think he tried, but he just didn't come up with anything.
Yeah, so I joined Omar and I was with him about 3.5 years, did his first record with him, Big Leg Beat, which was pretty much my first real time in the studio. The album holds up real well. We had a horn section come in. But I learned a lot from doing that session. The first record I ever did was in Rome with Richard on bass, a little 45. It's a little Christian record. And it kind of got my first time I heard myself on drums. Actually, the first time I heard myself on drums, I have to interject this. I lived on Booze Mountain Road in Silver Creek, Georgia, outside of Rome. And my parents went down to South Georgia to visit my dad's mom for the day. And so I had the guys come over, band we were playing in, and we recorded the first time at my house in my parents' den. And then all the guys left. And it was 2 hours later, a tornado hit our house. blew the roof off the house.
I remember hearing about this.
And that should have been a sign not to ever get in the music business. but that's what happened.
Right. I remember hearing that story.
So, then, of course, I have the earthquake tape from Santa Barbara when we were playing at the gallery when the earthquake hit.
Wow.
All the alarms were going off because it was Sunday afternoon.
Incredible.
So I have these interesting tapes.
Yeah. Well, you were just telling me on the way here about the fires in Santa Barbara. You said there was the one fire where you watched the city burn.
Yeah, we were in Carpinteria and sat on the roof.
And then what was the second thing?
Then it was
there was the mudslides.
Mudslides afterwards, right. And then they had the earthquake. That was the epicenter was only a mile off the coast. That's why it did so much damage. And it happened on a Sunday. So, and I lived right off State Street, and I was playing at this gallery that afternoon. But every glass shattered in every building on State Street. So all the alarms were going off. So it's this real eerie kind of...
And
it shook the building back and forth.
And Richard lasted a lot longer there, I guess.
Yes, he did. Yeah, he stuck around there.
Right. So Omar was the first group you were with in Austin. And then I think you said The Wheel?
Marsha.
Oh, Marsha was before The Wheel.
No, yeah, Marsha was before
The Wheel. Okay, so Marsha Ball... who's a very popular artist out of Austin now, and you're with her for, I think you said, 2 years?
Yeah, a couple of years, and it was it was really great. The first three or four bands, I learned so much musically as a drummer, and then just being with the bands I was with and playing the different parts of country, because like with Omar, we played the Deep South a lot. Now, we did do a lot of East Coast runs. Well, that's back when you could stay in one state and play seven gigs in a week in seven different towns, back in those days. But with Marsha, we went to Louisiana a lot, which you're talking about, I joined her in 82. So, I mean, New Orleans just had tons of clubs. There was Jimmy's, Tipitina's.
Right.
I mean, all the great clubs. And also between Omar and Marsha, both of them went to Chicago a lot. So... in the late 70s, early 80s, there was just, what a scene up there.
Big scene of blues.
Right, and I got to see a lot of the guys before they passed, or I would go see them because I'd met them at Antone's.
Right. Then you got on top of that, you got Antone's in the early 80s.
Yep.
And that was when it was really, really going strong.
It was.
And when did you start working with Blacktop? Was that with Anson or previous to Anson? Anson Funderburg were talking.
Yeah, Anson, no, my stuff started when we did that Trisexual Soul Champ
record. Okay.
Which, that's the first Blacktop record I did. And then because
and that's
of
with
that,
Mark Kazanoff on sax, Fats Jackson.
Fats Jackson.
And then who was Syl Austin?
Syl Austin.
Yeah, Syl Austin.
Yeah, I had the big million seller, was a birthday party or something like that in the 50s, the first sax.
I came and saw you guys at Tipitina's one night.
Yeah.
And I think Clarence Holloman was on the bill.
Clarence Holloman, and then on the record we had Snooks Eaglin and Floyd Domino. And
Snooks
Ron.
Might have been at that show now that I think about it,
But
yeah, those were some killer shows.
Man. Yeah, so because of that, that was my little short period of doing stuff with Blacktop, and then of course with Anson, we did a couple of Anson and Sam records that weren't Anson Funderburg and the Rocket records.
Right,
they were side projects.
Yeah,
and they were on Blacktop.
So the first Anson and Sam record on Blacktop, My Love Is Here to Stay, was you, Anson Funderburg on guitar, Doug Reinick on keys. I cannot remember the bass player's name.
I know he played with Room Full of Blues, but I can't think of his name
either. Was it McLeod?
I think it was.
Yeah.
Rory McLeod.
Yeah. And then Sam Myers singing and blowing harp, you playing drums. That album, 1984, floored me. And your drumming in particular really stood out. And I said to myself, in the back of my mind, I said, this is a guy I would love to be able to play with someday. So... fortunately, we were able to team up in 2010. I think we started doing tours together.
Right, we did.
With RW.
Right.
And we've been playing off and on since then. And 5 years in Golden State Lone Star with Anson and Little Charlie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So two records. And I think I did another record with Charlie on it with the Little Walter remembering Little Walter record. But so back to your time in Austin after Marcia, that was Asleep at the Wheel after that?
Asleep at the Wheel after Marcia. I had an offer to join them, and I took it. And because of them, you know, like with Marcia, being in New Orleans and in Louisiana, and being around the Meters and all those people, I learned firsthand how to play second line stuff and everything. And it's like with Omar's, where I was right there with all the blues people, you know, opening up or you know, meeting them. And then with Asleep at the Wheel, it was the same thing. It was, the timing was great, and I learned how to play Western swing, because a lot of the Bob Wilson's Texas Playboys guys were still alive. And we did a lot of touring back then with Willie Nelson, and of course Willie was good friends with Bob Wills and those guys. So we would do these tours where we'd bring out the guys that were still alive, which were a lot of them were back then, out on the road. We'd do a special segment, and they would get up individually, and then toward the end everybody would be out there. But the original drummer for Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys was Smokey Dacus, and he's considered the first country drummer. He put the backbeat to, so people could dance, because they played, you know, ballrooms, you know, like Kane's Ballroom, that was their home base.
Right.
And what he would do, what he told me, so that the dancers could hear a more defined beat, he would beat on his, for real loud, on his case. He sat on his trap case and would beat on 2 and 4.
That's amazing.
On that.
That is wild.
And put the backbeat to it. Because the snare was too soft.
Yeah.
And so he would hit on that on 2 and 4.
That is so
wild.
So
he put the backbeat to country.
And back then, I am assuming there was nothing was mic'd except for the vocal, right?
No, you know, you go into, you go into the old dance halls in Texas, which there's still about half of them still around, about 70, 80 dance halls around Texas. And you walk in, and halfway down the hall before you get to the bandstand, usually you'll see a 4 by 8 foot sheet of plywood with a 10 or 12 inch speaker in it. And that was the PA system.
That's amazing.
With cables running up to, all the way up to the stage. But playing with Sleep at the Wheel, and that was a hard working band. You know, the first year I was with them, we did 300 dates.
Wow.
You know.
And that is hardcore.
But, and it was a great band. I mean, Ray's always had really good bands.
Yeah.
And the band, particularly at the time that I joined, Chris O'Connell had come back.
Right.
And who was the original singer.
Who lives around here now.
Yep, yeah. She does. And then we had, for a time, we had Junior Brown playing
with
us. Right,
and that's how you hooked up with him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we had Wally Murphy on steel, who is, I'll say as he's thought of as the fastest steel player in the world.
Wow.
And he used to do like Flight of the Bumblebee and stuff just to blow people's minds. So, but he's in the, you know, they have the Steel Guitar Hall of Fame Museum is up in St. Louis, and they have their big convention every year. And with the Wheel, I got to play it twice.
Wow.
And all the great steel players there, Buddy Emmons, I mean, just honoring Jimmy Day, all these great old timers are there. But, you know, going back to the Wheel, playing with the Bob Wills guys, I really learned how to play it properly, where I really learned how to use brushes.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, one of the things that really is a defining feature that you have is being appropriate to each genre of music. You know, if you're playing blues, you're playing it the way it's supposed to sound. If you're playing country or swing, Western swing, you're playing it the way it's supposed to sound.
Well, I had good teachers.
But you're playing it your own way.
Right.
And that's what's so unusual, is for somebody to be able to play it in their own way, but at the same time authentically. And that's a very unusual.
Well, it's, you know,
feature.
So many different things have led to, I'll say, the last 25 years, I really have defined my style and keep refining it. But you really need to, I mean, I feel real fortunate to be around all the players I have in the different genres and get to see it up close and personal. Because standing right outside the stage and watching somebody play it, it's so powerful.
Yeah, it is.
It's very, very
powerful. It's a total learning experience.
And especially, I guess it is like that with all instruments, but I mean, for a drummer, because you can hear it, and you're going, how's he doing that? And then when you see him and the mechanics and the sticking, even as simple as it is, and then I would have to figure out how to do it because I play backwards and wrong. So because of that, it has my own interpretation.
Right.
And if you think about George Raines and Frosty and Fran Kristina, we're all lefties on a right-hand set. And we all got to be around each other.
That's
so
interesting.
So we all helped each other kind of do this constantly.
That's really interesting.
And we're able to sit on each other's set, but it was watching each other.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, that's how he does
that's
it.
That's so wild that all four of you guys
and we were around each other.
Were there.
For,
yeah, that's so
a
wild.
Lot of years, so.
That's amazing. Yeah. So now Fran Kristina is somebody that's, now was he in the Wheel before you?
Yeah, way before me. He, Roomful, the Wheel, and then T-Birds.
That's right.
I think that's the way it went.
You were with the Wheel for what, a couple years?
Not quite 2 years.
Okay.
And, you know, the other thing, I'm going to interject this, as years went by, I never burned a bridge with any of these bands. And because of that, as years have gone by, I mean, over the years, I've gotten calls to fill in for the Wheel's drummer. And Ray's real picky about drummers.
Yeah.
And there was only a couple of us. He wouldn't let his drummer take the time off if it was a wedding, a funeral, whatever it was, unless he could get one of just a couple of us.
Right.
Because it's so defined.
I can understand that.
You know, particularly with that music.
Yeah, I understand that. It makes a lot of sense.
So, yeah, so I was with them. And then I left to get off the road. From the Wheel in 85, and because I had a newborn at the house and a five-year-old. And so I wanted to get home and get into the local scene, and then I took a day job. So an electrical maintenance guy at Dillard's department store.
Wow.
And did that.
But you were playing gigs the whole time.
But only 6 weeks went by, and I got a call, kind of once-in-a-lifetime call from Mason Ruffner. He got asked by Jimmy Page. Jimmy had a new band with Paul Rogers called The Firm, and not by management, not by the record label, but Jimmy called Mason, wanted him to open up his tour because they had become friends in New Orleans.
Wow, because he had the gig. The Absinthe Bar.
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
Right, and so that's where they met, and they became friends.
That is so
wild. And with Jimmy and I became really good friends. So anyway, I ended up doing that tour, and Mason had asked me about a bass player. You know, something you were talking about earlier about how, we were talking about, oh, you can't do this gig in Nashville because you're too old, or, you know, because it's the image thing. Well, Mason's album was taken off, and he had a real high-profile management group and a bass player that I'd recommended to do the tour because Mason had asked me to find a bass player I was comfortable with to do this tour. And I told him John Bondell, who was a monster, who had played on one of Fingers records and stuff. He was a great trombone player.
Yeah.
But they didn't like the way he looked.
Wow.
So we got Sarah Brown.
That's so bizarre.
And so... Yeah. We went out and gallivanted around. You know, we were playing the hole in the wall across the University of Texas on a Tuesday night in front of 40 people. And then by Friday, we were playing the Omni in Atlanta in front of 18,000. So, and that's the way it went for the next, throughout the summer, whatever it was.
How crazy.
I can't remember, 4 or 5 months.
That's crazy.
You know, and the great thing about it was a great experience, and I got to be a rock star for a moment. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I had the highest respect for both those guys, Paul Rogers and Jimmy Page.
Right.
And they were so nice to us on the road. And, you know, we were in RV traveling and staying in whatever town we were playing in. But those guys would always fly in and out on a private jet from a hub city.
Right.
But when we would play that city, Jimmy would usually call my room, get my room number, and want me to go with him down one of the clubs because he wanted a shuffling drummer to go with him.
Oh,
and
wow.
We become good friends.
That's cool. That's cool.
You know?
Yeah.
And, kept the friendship up for quite a few years. I just kind of lost contact with him the last 15 years, but for a lot of years, we
that's nice.
In touch, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So did you ever do a hub city tour where you were flying out? With Hal, like, for example?
Yeah, with Hal, because we, Hal, when I was playing with Hal Ketchum, we moved up the ladder pretty quick And within a couple years, we had a full crew with a couple buses. And then on the biggest year for Hal, we'd be on the road, but we'd get a Learjet to fly halfway across the country to a festival that day and then fly back to meet the band. And so we did that one summer until we had a little accident in our plane, ran it off the end of the runway and put the front landing gear into the mud and pouring down rain.
Oh, my
but
God.
But I won't talk anymore about that.
Well, I mean, you were running down a couple of the really, you know, the bad bus accidents you were in.
Yeah, bad one.
Pretty horrific.
Head on one with when I was with Delbert.
Yeah.
And then had a really bad one with Hal Ketchum. So,
right.
So I've been in a plane wreck, two bus wrecks.
No, thank you.
Hit a deer.
Yeah, no, we hit a deer. Yeah, right. That was the tour that took me out for about a year, I think. And I've said this before when we did the one on the Road Dog episode, you know, is that you're traveling and it doesn't matter if you're in a van, a tour bus, a plane, your risks of getting in an accident or having some kind of bad juju come down increase every year as you've been out there.
Absolutely.
And the more you're out on the road, the more your odds increase, and it's kind of a disconcerting way to get through life, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because there's been a lot of musicians we've lost
that have died.
Yeah.
In accidents. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking about W.C. Clark or Jimmy Johnson.
Yeah, Willie's had a couple bad wrecks.
Has he?
Yeah, Willie Nelson had a couple really bad wrecks.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
tour bus wrecks.
So you know, it's just it's a weird existence, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean we've been off the road for the last year and a half here, and it's kind of like I'm really looking forward to playing, these gigs coming up, and it's like, at the same time, the idea of going back out on the road and doing month long tours is kind of like, it's a hard prospect at this point for me.
Well. I think at this point we all need to kind of, and I know we're in agreement, just kind of wait and see.
Yeah, wait and see what happens.
There's no hurry.
Yeah.
Like I was saying the other day, if it all stopped right now, except for the recording aspect of it, I would be okay with it.
Yeah, that's kind of where I got to.
I want to be able to record until I can no longer play. But but the touring is, I'm sure with both of us, is deep and... I went on my first tour when I was 15.
Wow.
Down to Florida.
Yeah.
You know, and...
See, you're way ahead of me.
I
was touring with my thumb. That's about
that's age. Another thing. Great thing about my parents is they allowed me to do that. And my parents would take us to the interstate about 20 miles from my house and would drop us off, and we would hitchhike all the way up to Allentown, Pennsylvania. I did this 3 years in a row.
Wow.
And then we'd take the bus into New York, have our tickets in advance, and we go all the great jazz shows.
That's amazing.
I got to see Mingus and Miles. I mean, everybody.
That's incredible.
And then we'd do the same thing coming back, and I call my parents, and they come pick us up.
Yeah.
But they were cool like that.
Yeah.
And it's back, and it was a tail end when you could do that.
Right.
And feel safe. I mean, one night we were picked up by the police, and they took us to the jailhouse. It's a little bitty town somewhere up in Virginia. It's outside of Roanoke, and they called my dad, and they put us up for the night, and they got us back out to the highway the next day. It was all good.
Yeah. I hitchhiked to the Monterey Jazz Festival the first time when I was about 16. Yeah.
I don't recommend it these days for anybody.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. So another great story I wanted you to tell people is the Tiny Tim in 1978.
Okay. Well, when I moved out.
No other drummers I know of can say they played with Tiny Tim.
Well, when I moved out to California, I played, first band I played with, it's a hit and run swing band, and we were kind of on the coattails of Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks, but we were just kind of following their path, and we got really good, and we're real popular on the Central Coast and in LA, but we played in Rome, and one of the clubs there had Tiny Tim coming in, and they hired us to back up, to open up for Tiny, and hired me and the bass player to play with Tiny and his keyboard player. And at the time, Tiny was living down in Florida. And so he came up from Florida and was doing a little southern tour. And so we played with him, and I'd seen him on Johnny Carson.
Of course, you know, yeah, he got married on there, yeah.
And so I was kind of in awe, and he was bigger in life, you know, I mean, he was a big man, and had, you know, the long hair, and very soft-spoken on stage, but that, not off stage.
Really?
Oh, yeah, he didn't talk like that off stage. But
interesting.
Yeah, so anyway, at the end of the night, Tiny and the keyboard player went back in the office to get paid.
Did he talk like this?
No, he didn't talk like that. But he said, I'll be right with you. And so me and Byron, you know, loaded up our equipment from the hit and run swing band in the van. And we sat in there for about a half hour. So about 45 minutes had actually gone by. So I went and knocked on the door, office door, and the owner opened it up. And he said, can I help you? And I said, oh, great show, by the way, you know, something like that. And I said, can I help you? I said, need to talk to Tiny. He needs to pay me and our bass player. He said, he left about 15, 20 minutes ago. He went out the back door. And he'd signed me a couple pictures. He'd autographed for me and stuff. And I just tore them up right there. So, anyway, I wish I had done that. And then
Money you could have made.
Yeah,
could have made more than the
exactly,
gig probably.
You know, the thing is, and back then you actually had cameras. And
right.
So I had to get film developed and had a bunch of pictures of us. And I tore them all up because I was so upset about how dare him.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But it was a learning experience because he had this professionalism that clicked on when he went on stage.
Interesting.
You know, and that was something that, you know, me and Byron have talked about that since, that it made you click into another gear. And he had that, him and the keyboard player.
Wow.
So not really knowing his stuff at all, what he was going to do, it was easy to follow because he had command.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I've always been really impressed. I remember one time watching James Cotton do a gig with Steve Freund where I picked up on just the abilities of a band leader being able to cue musicians on the spot and make them, you know, make them sound like a band that he's worked with a million times.
Yeah.
That's a true talent.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, and I've said this many times, the best guy I've ever been on stage with that can direct a band while he's counting the song off and pointing and stuff and it all makes sense is Delbert McClinton.
Okay, let's talk about him.
Delbert.
Yeah, because you worked with him twice.
I worked with him twice.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get fired either time.
Right.
But it was kind of a mutual understanding, you know, and he always took care of me when I left. But the first time I played with him, Nick Conde got me in the band. I met him in Santa Barbara. He's a keyboard player. Played in, I don't know if you remember this band, Spliff. They were the big...
I have heard
West
of that
Coast
band.
Reggae band.
Yeah, I have heard of that
70s.
Band. Wow.
And
so both you and Anson were in reggae bands.
No, Anson was. Anson
he was in a reggae band. Yeah.
And so I knew Nick from California, and Nick moved out to Texas a year after I did, and actually lived in my house for 6 weeks till he could find a place. Him and his family, young family, stayed there while I was on the road with Omar. So down the road, Nick ended up playing. He was actually the first keyboard player with Stevie.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He played around town. Him and Denny were kind of like ghost members in that band.
Right.
Denny Freeman.
Yeah.
And
I knew Denny was...
Because he did that with the
T-Birds. He was in the Cobras, right?
Yeah. And Denny
and Stevie were in the Cobras.
Right.
Yeah.
But he was a really great piano player and actually toured quite a bit with the T-Birds early on as a keyboard player. But anyway, so Nick was playing with Delbert. And they were losing their drummer. It was right after Delbert did that great live album from Austin City Limits, and which is a wonderful record. And the drummer left, and so I got a shot at it. And my rehearsal was in a studio, or my audition / rehearsal, we actually did a Schlotzky's commercial. Sandwich commercial.
The deli,
we did a sandwich commercial.
I love that.
And that was my audition, basically.
Wow.
Basically. That's the way
it interesting.
Went. And, you know, Delbert, I learned so much from Delbert. And he was, Delbert could be tough, but he was never like that with me.
Yeah.
We hit it off, and because he was known to be one of those band leaders that's hard on drummers.
Right.
And and he was fine. He was, we got along great, and I learned so much from him. And then it was, it was just time to move on. But Al Ketchum needed a drummer, and a mutual friend of ours called me up, and so I went and played. Actually, I think it was the day before Christmas, first time I played with him, and it went really well. So I started playing with him when he needed a drummer, because a lot of times he did stuff without drummer, because he was more of the folk.
Singer-songwriter?
Yes, singer-songwriter stuff. And so when Hal went to Nashville, he got a writer's deal first and had written some songs that artists had picked up, and then he got a artist deal. So they made a record, Small Town Saturday Night, they made a record, and then out of the blue, after not talking to him for years, he called me up and said, "Hey, I want you to be in my band. I've got this album coming out, and I want to use my Texas guys. Nashville wants me to use these guys up here, but if I can get you and Keith and Scotty, I want to use you guys."
Yeah.
And we may add one guy from up here, but I want that.
That
I want
sound.
It, yeah, I don't want it to be, you know, homogenized and just, right. Filtered and just, just be stock stuff out because you guys play my stuff good. So they watched us like a hawk for about the first 6 months. And we went out on the road when Hal's single broke top 40. And when it got up to number one, they left us alone. And we were good to go.
Yeah.
And so then we moved over to Nashville. We all relocated over to Nashville to be, because it, as you know, it's just easier to tour.
Sure.
Nashville and Memphis are great locations to tour, because you can go play
power
weekends on 30-something states and
That's
go home.
That's right.
So it's just easier. Yeah. From Texas, it takes a day to get out of the damn state.
Absolutely.
So it just seemed like the right thing to do. And then things just kind of kept going. And it was a good run for me.
Now that was 7 years? Is that what it was?
It was not quite five. But we had 14 top 10 hits.
Wow.
And sold 5 million records.
Wow.
It was, and I really... By then, from learning from my mistakes of not paying attention to what was going on in other bands, I really paid attention and took it in, because it was really the big time.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a tour doing big time stuff. It was,
right.
I was part of it, and it was, the band, as a band, was critically acclaimed because we had a sound.
Right.
And I always considered us, even though we were four-piece, for a long time until we had a keyboard, we were four-piece. Our fifth instrument were the vocals, because Scotty and Keith, bass player, guitar player, sang incredible. They were incredible singers, and with Hal, their voices were special. So that was our fifth instrument.
Yeah,
and we used it, and we became a very powerful unit, because Hal would write a song in the hotel room, and then we'd get on the bus the next morning, bus call, and he'd have the guys break out the guitars, and they'd run it down and tweak it, and then we get to the next town, go and do a sound check, go run it down and play it that night in front of 5,000 people.
That's incredible.
That's how much confidence we had.
That's serious confidence.
And so he relied on us a lot, and he was, it was great for a long time.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of watch what I say here.
I know he just recently passed.
He recently passed, and we buried the hatchet. But, with a lot of he had his demons and stuff. And when he got serious, he quit drinking, and he was quit for almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then when he showed up at my hotel room, we may have to edit this out. I showed up at my hotel room in London, knocked on the door, and out of respect, none of us drank. Mm-hmm. And what drinking did go on would be maybe a nightcap or something.
Right.
We all curbed our drinking because of respect for him, was going on and the big picture. And he knocked on the door, and I opened the door, and he had a bottle of champagne and two glasses. And I thought to myself, it's over.
Yeah.
I did.
Really
did.
Wow.
And we were like blood brothers. And when I finally approached him about it, because things started to get kind of wild, and, we were like a machine as far as timing and, be here, be here, there. All that started going away. That sloppiness started coming in.
Yeah.
And I finally went to him and said something to him about it, and he didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
He basically fired me.
Wow.
But the reason he finally gave me, he had management fire me, but the when I finally did talk to him a week or so later after that went down, and I was heartbroken from it.
I bet.
I finally talked to him. He finally answered the phone, and he gave me the best answer I ever heard for being fired. He said, I said, so how? What's going on? He said, well, you're fired. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, Wes, every time I look back at you, you look like you're possessed by the spirit of Gene Krupa. And I went, well, thank you.
That is a compliment.
But what happened, because when you bring, you know, the alcohol and the drugs back in, things get twisted in your head. And Hal has always been great with his fans and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, all of a sudden, when he started back doing that nonsense, when people come up and say, oh, your band's great, or particularly, oh, your drummer's phenomenal,
he didn't want to hear it. No, that's typical.
That's because of the...
very typical.
Of that stuff. So, anyway, so he let me go, and then, a month later, Delbert called me up, and I was
back in with Delbert.
So...
yeah.
You know, it's just...
You've had a lot of very good luck in terms of landing on your feet.
Yeah.
In almost all these situations.
You know, like earlier I was telling you, when I got a call to join Dixie Chicks, I turned it down because I was with Delbert, because you never leave a band for another band unless you truly have their blessings there.
Right.
Or you take it. Like, you know, when I left Delbert's band the first time, the way I left was we were backstage at a club in Copenhagen, and a couple guys from Polygram Records came backstage, and I was talking to Delbert and his wife, and they come right up, and they were, you know, said, oh, it was a great show, blah, blah, blah. And they wanted to talk to me, said, we'd like to offer you a contract as a staff drummer for Polygram Scandinavia.
Wow.
And Delbert and Wendy were right there, and I thought it was just perfect, and I just kind of looked at them. Delbert says, you better take that.
Wow, that's
so
smart.
So I did,
and
basically what I was doing was me and Frosty, for that year, either he'd be drumming or I'd be drumming. We would Barry Frost. Frosty played with Lee Michaels, just great drummer.
Famous drummer.
And had played with Delbert years before I did, and had left, and enough time had gone by, he felt comfortable coming in and playing a tour, and then have a month off, and then I come in and do a tour.
Right.
So we worked it out between me and him.
Yeah.
Everything's covered. And then it got to where I couldn't be around as much, and so Frosty became the drummer, and I permanently left.
Right.
But that's how the transition went.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to get into is just your time around a lot of the singer-songwriters in Austin, like Tish...
Tish Hinosa.
I know. I don't pronounce her name well.
Tish Hinosa.
Hinosa, who I know Gary Primich was also in the band at the same time, I think. Harmonica player, friend of mine. And then the other one is Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that he played with. Stephen Bruton
was
another friend of yours.
Joe Ely and Butch
Joe
Hancock.
Ely.
And they were
runners
of Flatlanders.
The Flatlanders, yeah.
Well, you know, that happened because when I decided to get off the road... And then, but the Mason gate came up, so I did that. So after that was done, then I got off the road and I got my job, which I had just started at Dillard's as an electrical maintenance guy. They took me back because they needed someone. And I started playing with a lot of the singer-songwriters around town.
Yeah.
And that was another incredible experience for me, you know, to really tune in to, you know, because they're very... those singer-songwriters are very particular.
Right.
You know, the subtleties are so important to them.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And the lyrics, and also with the music behind it.
Yeah.
It's very important for
and
them.
And you're saying you saw Townes Van Zandt passed under a pool.
Well, I met a lot. I mean, I met Jerry Jeff Walker, him. Most of those guys, usually when I met them, were passed out underneath the table.
Right.
And then down the road.
How about Blaze? What was
Blaze? Blaze Foley.
Yeah, did you know him?
I knew. Yeah, Blaze actually, in his band, was only one other guy, the Eager Beaver Valley Boy. That was his band, one other guy. They went with Paul in the van with Omar, and I think we did two tours together where we had Blaze.
Really?
And his buddy. Open up. But my watering hole was, my local watering hole where I went to drink was the Austin Outhouse.
Okay.
Which is made famous in a movie about Blaze Foley.
Right.
But that was just literally blocks away from where I live. So that's where I first saw a lot of people, a lot of the writers.
What was your take on the film?
It was...
About Blaze.
I left there kind of, I thought it was done really well. I thought Charlie Sexton was great in it. I thought the acting was wonderful, and I thought it was pretty true to form, but it just kind of brought back memories, and it was depressing.
Yeah, it was kind of depressing.
It was a heavy movie.
The ending was very depressing.
Yeah, because the Blaze that I knew, and it portrayed it a lot in the movie, he was very upbeat, very up.
Was he?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Well, you know, with the songwriters, what it did was really help hone my skills recording to another level. But even though I was recording, anywhere from 3 to 5 records with different artists a year with those people, it was just totally different, and it just upped my game. I became a much better drummer and really started becoming a studio drummer. You know,
right.
And understand the concept, because like with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, I mean, the three producers, I did 3 records with him in a row over about a 5-year period, and we had Joe Ely produced one, Stephen Bruton produced one, who was a longtime guitar player with Chris Christopherson,
right.
You know, and then Emory Gordy Jr., which was that when I went in the studio to do my 5 songs with Jimmy in Nashville, that I called it my Elvis day, because he had Glendy Harden there and Emory Gordy played bass.
Wow.
And you know, it was kind of the Elvis. And it was,
that's heavy.
We knocked the songs out just like that.
Yeah,
and
that's
then
heavy.
The other 2 hours, or other 4 hours probably, because we spent about 2 hours out of a 6-hour session recording, and the rest Elvis stories.
Wow. So, crazy.
But you know, working with guys like that, producers at that level, they know what they want, they know how to talk to you, they know how to get it out of you.
Right.
You know.
Right. And I was going to say, you know, anyone doing sessions in Nashville, you can't be a slouch. You've got to be a serious.
You know, the other thing about a guy that has been there, key timing for me, is the way I got to Sleep at the Wheel. It was through Johnny Gimble, the fiddle player.
Okay, right.
And the way that happened was when I went down to do the audition, I went into the office, and it was just the bass player and Ray, you know, and I thought that was going to be the whole band there, right?
Right.
And it was just us two, and I'm going, oh, my God, and I'm sitting up my drums, and we get ready to play, and in walks Johnny Gimble. He just came by the office, and Ray said, pull out your fiddle. So we played a couple of songs, and Johnny looked at Ray and said, hire him.
Wow.
And so that's how I got it.
This sounds like a very similar story. Demar, the drummer,
yeah.
Demar played with Little Richard for 20
yeah,
years.
Exactly.
And he had a very similar story about Richard taking him to a club of Roy Gaines, the guitar player.
Right.
And that Roy and Richard got on stage and said, come on up here and play. And they started just playing blues for like 3 hours.
Mm. And that was his real audition.
You got the gig. Yeah, that was his audition.
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting how people, a lot of times they will kind of put you in a very comfortable situation where it's not a stress thing.
Right.
It's just being relaxed.
Right.
See,
and
how
then,
you can
so,
do.
So when I moved to Nashville, when I was flying up to Nashville to look for a house, I happened to be right across the aisle from Johnny Gimble.
Wow.
And there was a seat open next to me, so he moved over and we talked. And I told him what was going on. He was happy I was going to be playing, you know, moving up there playing with Hal. He said, be interested in doing some studio work? And I said, well, yeah. He said, well, I'm going to call a buddy of mine. Here's his number. He'd give me a couple of weeks and then call him. Well, I didn't have to wait. The guy called me. And the way it works in Nashville, you really do, as they say, you got to have some talents are given, but then you have to be on time and you have to be really nice.
Wow.
And I heard that out of Johnny's mouth. They said,
wow.
He said they used to have a guy, out of tune somebody was his name, guitar player, but he was the guy that was always there at the studio,
yeah.
And he was an okay player, but yeah. he was the nicest guy in the world. Nobody could fire him because he was so nice and always on time. They couldn't fire him. So anyway, through Johnny,
yeah.
He got me in the door because they have a list. Because in Nashville, you have your road players and you have your studio players, and there's not a whole lot of people that do both because you have to be on call, basically.
Wow.
If they call you and you don't answer, you don't respond,
right.
They'll get somebody else. And
right.
I've seen the list of 1 to 50 players down the list of who they're going to call and stuff. And I saw that when I got to MCA Studios, a publishing company where they do all their demos, I saw the list of players, and I'm going, why am I here? but
that's got to be gratifying.
But the thing is, so when I'd be off the road from Howe, I could call down there and say I'm available, because it wasn't making records. It was the next process of getting the song from the songwriter from their rough demo in to put a band around that song and to keep the integrity of the song in place. But don't spend a lot of time on it, but the things that are important.
Right.
And with a simple formula to present it to the artist.
So it's a demo.
It's a demo for
doing
the,
demos.
going to the artist.
Interesting.
And that was an incredible experience. And that's where I really became a good in the studio and quick.
Yeah.
Because I learned how to be quick with those guys.
Yeah, I bet you did.
You know, you got to be like two steps ahead as a drummer. Yeah.
Wow. So we're going to take a little break right here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to play something for you live in the studio.
Absolutely.